Good morning, Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. For the benefit of Justice Ridgely, I'm prepared to recite a brief factual history or posture of the case. If not, I can proceed forward into our argument.
It's unnecessary.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice. Members of the court, this is a textbook case for why parties who commit spoliation and who intentionally withhold evidence in violation of a court's discovery order should face severe sanctions. The fundamental question raised by this case at this particular posture is, if a thief destroys or conceals evidence of the value of what he stole or converted, what should the trial court do in that situation?
Well, what is the sanction that you're looking for? I mean, you already have a judgment on liability.
Yeah, we're looking for a sanction relating to our proof of the damages and the extent of the damages. Because as the court will see from the argument, the actions...
So you're looking for a jury instruction that says what?
Well, that would be our backup. That would be our fallback position. We maintain that the spoliation and disobedience to the court's order that occurred in this case cannot simply be cured by an adverse inference. First off, we want our case back, number one. In the face of the spoliation that was committed and the flagrant disobedience of the trial court's order to produce documents in this case, the trial court did nothing. To the contrary, the trial court turned around and granted summary judgment, and before granting summary judgment indicated that not only was she not going to do anything about the spoliation, she indicated that she preempted us from even discussing spoliation and the actions that the bank took in presenting our case, which obviously...
Let me interrupt for a second, because you keep talking about spoliation. I thought that ultimately it was determined that the optical records have all of the information that would, you know, give you complete data.
Well, they do not. They do not. What happened is...
Wait a second. Have you ever seen the optical records?
We know we are generally aware. We haven't seen them because they have not been translated into a readable format. There's an optical storage that the bank put 384 of the 855 accounts into when they did the purging back in 2001. Of course, they didn't tell anybody about it for 4 years.
Right, but tell me why, if you got the optical records, you wouldn't have everything you need.
Well, because the documents have been damaged, or so to speak, or have been purged.
Optical records have
the
been?
Optical records have. All the optical records are is the access, essentially the access database type of information. They contain a referred amount, the amount that was originally written off by the bank. They don't have the actual amount that is available. They have the referred amount, and they have the referred amount, and if they could be translated, which the bank admitted they could, at a cost of an hour per account. Now, they knew just 10 months before the damages trial was supposed to happen. But if they could convert them, they would simply be converted back, and they have a code. In addition to the charged-off amount, they have a specific code, XIF, paid in full. The problem is that does not accurately reflect what the bank received on those accounts. The example of Ray Bruner's account is appropriate. Ray Bruner is one of the six sample accounts that they provided complete information for, complete RMS information, recovery management system information for. Ray Bruner's account showed that in total the bank collected $16,000 on a $10,000 charged off amount. So they collected excess recoveries, which include attorney's fees, post-judgment interest, cost, things of that nature. Ray Bruner's account is one of the ones they put into the optical storage. If you look at the optical storage, all it says is they collected, it's called the access database, all it says is they collected $10,000 on Ray Bruner's account. The other $6,000 is in the bank's pocket. We really don't know what the optical storage says because we don't have the information from it. We were given the access database.
But you never requested the optical.
Yes, we did.
When did you request
We requested information with respect to what is in the accounts or what was recovered on these accounts And in 2005, in January 2005, the trial judge said to the bank, you will produce data the same as the six sample accounts for all the other accounts that Empire is interested in. That data did not exist because what happened is every single account had been purged. And
right, but see, I'm having a problem here, and I would just, you know, if you can give me a yes or no answer, that would be great. But my understanding is that at various points in time, you were told the data is not available, the data has been purged, the data has been, you know, somehow redacted, whatever. And that after you were told all of those things and given some limited information, you also discovered that there were these optical records, which were complete records, unpurged, but, you know, it would be very difficult and time-consuming to, you know, bring them out of optical storage. Is that correct or not?
That's not correct because we don't know what is in optical storage. We've never been given that.
Okay, but haven't you been told that what's in the optical storage is the complete records?
Well, we're told in a sense that these 384 accounts are represented by the, they call it the access database. As I indicated, that information is not accurate.
Right, but You seem to be basing your argument on the fact that you couldn't get the information and that it's because the bank destroyed information or didn't preserve it or whatever. And at least as I, granted, I may be confused, but as I understand the record here, the bank does have the complete accurate information. It's just very hard to get to.
No, the only complete accurate information we have are the six sample accounts that were furnished. Within a month of the court order, or within a month of the bank providing those documents, this is back in May of 2001, they purged the files. What happened as a consequence of purging the files is that approximately half, there was information for half the accounts that is truncated and backdated, but similar to the six sample accounts. The six sample accounts show every payment that's received and so forth. In Ray Brunner's case, 25 payments were made, $13,000 were collected in 25 payments from Ray Brunner's account. And we know who made the payments, when they were paid. When they purged the documents for at least the half that they've provided truncated records for, when they purged the documents for the ones they provided the truncated records for, they took that information like Ray Brunner's, but they would have compressed it and backdated it to make it, the effect of which was to lower the balances that Empire would be due on those documents. Further, for the other half of the accounts, the ones that are in the access database, all we know about that is we were told they're snapshots of accounts. And again, looking at the access database or the thing that's in optical storage, the information in optical storage, it's basically that there's a charged-off amount that's reflected, which doesn't reflect the actual amount that was obtained on the account, and there is a code, which we have demonstrated to the trial court that they're basically unreliable codes. They've got the accounts that are indicated that they're bankrupt, and we've got a little bit of information from what we do have to show they receive payments after the fact and so forth. The problem is we don't know what's in that. We don't know what's in the optical storage. The bank has paid its expert $300,000 to project what's in the optical storage. The bottom line is we're talking ancient history. They should know to the penny what they collected on the accounts that they recalled, and they claim they don't. They're saying, well, here, we can give you some estimate or whatever of what we collected. They should know what they collected, and if they've despoiled evidence, they knew they were under a duty to preserve those documents because the court, when the trial court ordered the six sample accounts to be produced, it said, look, the bank complained it was too burdensome to produce the information. The trial court said, okay, look, I'm going to order a sample, and we'll see where we go with that.
There was no litigation hold order entered.
Well, there had been a subpoena for the documents way back in 1997, We were trying to get the information as to what was in them. We filed a motion to compel on those. In May of 2001, the trial court says, okay, I'm going to order six sample accounts produced, and we're going to see where that goes. Within a month after that, they purged the accounts. Now, we didn't know about it for 3 or 4 years because it was ensuing litigation over the contract, and then there was an appeal when the first summary judgment was ordered in this case.
So
it was an appeal.
Is the answer to my question no, there was no litigation hold order?
Well, there was no litigation hold, but clearly there was an understanding of, well, I take that back. I'm not sure if their general counsel knew about it. Counsel for the bank, Pepper Hamilton, knew about the litigation. They knew that these documents were in play. We would maintain that there was
no signed order of Judge Del Pesco or any other Superior Court judge saying preserve these documents.
There was no signed order, but clearly there was a constructive order by the court that when the court said, look, we're going to order a sample produced and we'll see where that goes, to destroy the documents within a month after that, we feel basically reflects an intentional destruction and virtually an intentional disobedience to the court's order.
But the court found otherwise, didn't it?
Well, the court found that it was negligent, but the bottom line was...
So the answer is yes.
Well, there was no evidence to support the court's finding. In point of fact, the evidence is that it was an intentional destruction. It wasn't a situation where someone pushed the wrong button and wanted to copy and said, whoops, I pressed erase. The court knew... I mean, they knew that these documents, they intentionally purged them. It wasn't an accident, and they were under a duty to preserve the documents. There was pending litigation. They knew those documents are the heart of the case. They basically present for us the floor of the damages in our case. What did the bank receive as a consequence of its conduct? That's our starting point. We submit that we would have done better. Empire would have done better collecting those accounts because they were given to Empire in the first place because the bank couldn't collect them. They were written off by the bank. And furthermore, it's clear that any time...
The first element of damages then is whatever the bank collected on those accounts, there's an assumption that's the base or the minimum that you would have collected.
Exactly. I mean, that's the base because anytime you interrupt an account, and there's evidence in the record to this effect, anytime you interrupt, they've even admitted it, one of their employees admitted, anytime you interrupt a collection... like that, where a person's paying on an account, you say, we're going to change collectors. First thing they do is they stop making the payments until someone gets on them. In fact, the evidence in this case is that there were four-month delays. It was at least, I think, in a Ray Brunner account, there was a four-month delay once they took the accounts back before Brunner started paying again. And, of course, we don't have records to show how many other delays there were, but we can at least prove it in a case where we do have documentation.
Well, departing momentarily from the issues about the availability of data or documents, and focus on the elements of damages, what's the relationship between the base element that you've just established and the trial judge's finding that Empire had no history of handling consumer loan accounts for the bank and offered no testimony about how much, if anything, Empire would have collected or what the cost would have been, and therefore the measure of damages of reasonable profitability was totally absent from the record?
We don't dispute the judge's ruling on the consumer loan accounts, okay? Because the consumer loan accounts were just one small piece of this. What we're talking about are the credit card accounts. That's a different segment of business that Empire lost as a consequence of the actions, but basically we're not disputing the trial judge's ruling on that limited consumer loan account body of information.
So there's a different factual situation in regard to the credit card accounts?
Oh, absolutely. The credit card accounts were money in the bank, essentially.
Okay.
The Empire had spent 10 years building a portfolio of $2 million worth of paying illegal accounts. The money was coming in, okay? Empire had the business opportunity as a consequence of what happened to collect out those accounts to get its commissions on those accounts. That's what Empire lost, that opportunity to liquidate this $2 million inventory.
And there was then testimony offered on what the costs were related to that and what the net profit would have been?
Well, here's the situation as far as the profit. The case has kind of been misconstrued as a net profits case. The bank, essentially, the bank's argument is this. If I go down to the Chrysler plant and steal a Durango, I don't have to pay Chrysler for stealing that Durango because Chrysler lost $1 billion last year. That's essentially what their argument is. Or, conversely, Chrysler has to deduct the cost of making the Durango from that. What happened in this particular case is the heart was taken out of Empire when those accounts were taken, okay, the heart of its business. The inventory of paying illegal accounts, which had been developed over a 10-year period of time and were paying off. Empire's expenses the year preceding that were high because Empire was still a going concern. When you take the heart out of a business, it's like it's too late for a transplant. You've killed the business, but you've also, in this particular case, stolen an asset. The only appropriate expense from that asset is the expense to liquidate the paying illegal accounts, not to continue operating as a going concern.
Well, let me try and cut through this. Assuming your expert is excluded from testifying, as the trial court decided, what evidence did you have ready to show to a jury that you suffered damages, including what evidence of the costs of collection?
Well, the evidence that we did have, obviously, putting it in context of the way this thing happened, the motions to exclude the expert and for summary judgment were filed months after the expiration of dispositive motions cutoff date, 3 weeks before trial.
Forget that. I want to know, given the posture we're in now, where the trial court said your expert is out, what evidence could you have gone to trial with that would show what your damages were?
Assuming, for summary judgment purposes, all we need to show is we have some damage, okay? Gwen Wood testified in the first trial. This court cited it in this court's opinion that as far as summary judgment is concerned, she testified Empire was making $22,000 a month in profit from the paying illegal accounts.
Okay, but the trial court said that that was wrong and that there was no evidence of that.
Well, the trial court said it was wrong, but the trial court's ruling is inconsistent with the record. But be that as it may, the other evidence we have is that the bank has admitted in responses to requests for admission that they collected $600,000 on paying illegal accounts. Now, that was supplanted, according to the trial judge, by PricewaterhouseCoopers, who said, really, what we think they collected was $810,000. So that's $405,000 of commissions that Empire should be entitled to at the very least. That's the floor of error.
Wait a second. But there's still a cost that has to be applied to that number, isn't there?
That's right.
And what's the evidence of what your cost of collection was?
The evidence of the cost is in the form of affidavits submitted in response to the motion for summary judgment by Gwen Wood, the lady who testified about the $22,000 profit, and Mr. McCary, the owner of the company. They basically testified as to the limited expenditure that would be necessary to recover the paying illegal accounts. Basically, you're talking one secretary working part-time, earning $12 an hour, and, you know, to keep the legal accounts coming, there was virtually no effort. Processed 25 checks. In Ray Brunner's case, processed 25 checks to recover $9,000.
Okay, let me ask you one other thing. When the trial court excluded your expert witness on June 8th, did you request time to locate another witness?
June 8th was a couple days before trial.
I'm asking whether you requested more time.
We didn't request more time because, frankly, our feeling was the trial judge would not have given it to us. We had a trial scheduled. She was entertaining summary judgment on the eve of trial. She ruled on the summary judgment motion the second day of what was supposed to be the trial. And as I indicated, these motions were filed months after the case dispositive motion's cutoff date.
You want to save your last minute?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Duncan Grant on behalf of the Bank of New York, Delaware. Let me speak first briefly about the sanctions issue and, if I may, directly answer Justice Berger's questions about the optical database. Justice, the answer is that on page A2045, paragraph 15, which is part of the Peter Bailing Declaration, the optical storage system is described. It was disclosed. It's described as essentially a snapshot of the recovery management system documents that existed at the time that the recovery management system records were transferred into two other databases. So that's the answer to your question.
Wait a second. Let's put this in simpler terms. It sounds like opposing counsel was correct then that the optical database would not be a complete recreation of the original records.
If there was any collection after that date, that's correct. Now, it's not likely that there were any collections after that date because the record also shows through testimony from our man, James Longshaw, that the only records that were transferred out of the RMS, Recovery Management System, were records that were in so-called final status. They had been sold, they'd been paid in full, a full settlement had occurred, so no more collections would take place. The debtor had died or the debtor was bankrupt. So is it possible there was that some collections occurred after that date? It's possible. Were they material? Probably not.
Well, wait a second. If the bank has an account that they're not collecting on and they either close it out because they're not able to collect on it or they sell it to somebody else or transfer it to somebody else, that may be the end of it from the bank's perspective. But for purposes of this litigation, if that was an account that was obtained improperly and if the original collectors could have continued with that account, arguably it would have been a different result, right? I mean, at least arguably.
Well, arguably a few dollars could have been collected. But if we take, for example, an account that was sold, the bank always had the right to sell accounts, and it did routinely sell accounts.
Right, but you don't sell accounts that are paying, do you?
You know, you do sometimes.
If you've got a collection agency that's doing its job and bringing in the money every month from the debtor, the bank is going to say, oh, here's a nice paying account. We're going to get rid of it?
Yes. The bank was going out of the business. The bank sold hundreds of thousands of accounts and blocks to J.P. Morgan Chase and others. So it may seem counterintuitive, but the answer is yes, that did happen. Now, with respect to the – let me speak more broadly about the sanctions situation. And I submit that the way to analyze what happened, keeping in mind that the scope of review is abuse of discretion, is let's look at the conduct by the bank. Let's look at the intent of the conduct, the consequences of the conduct, and the remedy given by Judge Del Pesco.
Before you get into that, am I correct that the bank has never done a purge other than the 1 month after the discovery was given?
No, that's not correct. The Peter Bailing affidavit, same affidavit, paragraph 11 on page A2043, shows that there were four such events: August 1999, October 2000, then the one to which Mr. Radulski referred, the summer of 2001, and then May 2002. And that also gets, Your Honor, to my point about intent of the bank with respect to this situation. The bailing affidavit establishes, and here's the basis for Judge Del Pesco's conclusion about negligence. The bailing affidavit establishes that people at the computer center in New York, not working with the Delaware operation, which is the defendant here in particular, but with all of the banks within the Bank of New York family of banks that have anything to do with retail customers, car loans, personal loans, et cetera, had to get rid of records from their database for charged-off accounts because the database was going to become too full and would simply shut down, and they couldn't use it for any purpose. So they looked at alternatives to see how they could deal with this, compressing data, expanding the size of the database. They had teams of people looking at this, and their conclusion was the only way to deal with it is to move data out into these other databases. The negligence, I believe, found by Judge Del Pesco is that those people were not liaising or coordinating with general counsel. They were not coordinating with the Delaware operation. It is established without dispute in Mr. Bailing's declaration that they knew, the computer people knew nothing about Empire. They knew nothing about the Empire litigation. They were simply doing a job to preserve the integrity of the data system. Now, if we look then at the three key points that Empire charges were problems with respect to the data and then look at Judge Del Pesco's remedy, we'll see that she engaged in a very logical, deductive, highly reasoned process. He's talked almost exclusively in argument about about the movement of the data. So what was the remedy that Judge Del Pesco awarded? She first of all recognized that for a majority of the accounts, a point that hasn't come out yet this morning, for a majority of the accounts, the RMS records still existed and were turned over. And there's an issue through inadvertence. Some of them were turned over a little bit on the late side, and that was raised in the sanctions motion. So the remedy was...
Isn't there a question about whether those RMS records are entirely accurate because they are cut off at certain points in time?
That's not the problem with them. The problem is that in the original, if it's my account and I make six payments, there's six entries. Through the same process with Mr. Bailing and the data transfer, it's explained in his affidavit, his declaration, that those six payment entries might be consolidated into a single entry. The dollar total that was paid remains accurate. There is integrity to that. The total amount paid on the account is accurate. The total balance due is accurate. There is no question about that. So
what if the account was written off?
Well, all of these accounts...
Won't it show a balance due of zero?
No. It'll show on the bank's balance sheet, it'll show zero.
No,
because,
on the RMS.
But on the RMS, no. It'll show the exact amount owing.
So even if you've closed that account, it'll show you closed it with a balance due.
Correct. All of these accounts are charged off, every single one of the 855 accounts. When payments are made, the arithmetic is done in the RMS record, and the bottom line shows the amount still due, and you can determine, and it shows the amount that was due when charged off, shows the amount paid. That's whether or not the payment entries have been consolidated. So it is not true that the consolidation of payment entries caused a glitch or an error in the bottom line dollars owing. And Judge Del Pesco recognized that. But the remedy she awarded was, she said, Empire can file supplemental expert reports. So that remedy directly addressed the problem. She also required the bank to pay Empire's fees and costs for pursuing the sanctions motion, which we have done. Now, there were other points they raised with respect to the sanctions motion. There's an issue about an affidavit which had an omission in it, which we admitted it omitted. 12 days later, that affiant was deposed. She volunteered the information. It came out 12 days later. Empire complains about that in their papers, not here at oral argument. Judge Del Pesco said the bank pays the fees of Empire for taking that deposition, which we have done. So the remedy directly addresses the problem. And then with respect to the access database, which we haven't talked about much this morning, that was produced to Empire as well as, frankly, to our experts after their expert report was turned over. And they said our expert should have been able to see it. And the judge said, that's right. It's been turned over now, even before Empire requested it, but it's been turned over after their expert report. Let him supplement his report, which he did. Now, the fact of the matter is that their expert, neither in his original nor in his supplemental report, even used one of the RMS records that were available, not one. For a majority of the accounts, the RMS records were available. He didn't use a single one of them, and that's his choice. But I think that's an important point for the court to know. Now, if I may turn to the issue of costs. Clearly, lost profits equal lost revenues minus the costs that would be incurred to generate them. No question about that. Empire's position has been basically, gee, there really weren't any costs. And I'd like to go through, if I could, how that issue evolved in the litigation.
Interrupt you there. I understand that there's a dispute about what the costs of recovery would have been, but why doesn't a jury decide, you know, hearing both sides, that, there would be substantial costs, or no, there would be virtually no costs at this point in the collection process and moving forward, and therefore we look at the total amount that the bank collected, divide that by two because we were supposed to get 50%. Am I correct on that?
You are correct on that. Yes, ma'am.
And then deduct, $100,000 for all the costs or $50,000 for all the costs, because we say the costs would be nominal and would only be the cost of a secretary making a phone call once a week or something. You say the costs would be enormous and a jury decides which of those costs they think is accurate?
Well, the answer is that they have to have admissible evidence to get to a jury to demonstrate their theory, and they have none.
What about their employees who do this job and are going to testify as to how much time and effort it takes to keep a collection going?
Let's talk about those. There are two-page affidavits. Gwen Wood, a Long Before employee, testifies in her affidavit that there would be certain minimal expenses. She has no explanation. She just says, here are the expenses, and she says something like $200 a month. She doesn't explain, nor does Mr. McCary in his affidavit, which is the other one that they rely upon, why they would have only had to incur certain expenses.
Well, did you take their depositions?
I did. Well, McCary, not Wood.
And they had no answer to your questions about that?
No, they really didn't. They said, here's my theory, we wouldn't have any expenses. That's basically the sum and substance of it. The Empire did not present that to Judge Del Pesco in opposition to summary judgment, however.
Well,
what they complained about was...
Didn't they present those two affidavits?
They did. They did.
Doesn't that at least create a factual record from which summary judgment can't be granted?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. The mere fact that one presents an affidavit is not sufficient. The affidavit under Rule 56 has to contain admissible evidence, and here's why it's not admissible. This is really classic.
I have a more basic question. Why do they have to present any evidence at all if there's already a judgment that Empire has been damaged?
There's a difference. I think you're getting, Your Honor, to the difference between fact of damage and measure of damage. The liability...
Well, at least $1, isn't it?
There is case law going both ways on whether it's just $1 or it's nothing. But their proposition is that they wanted to prove damages of, they tell us, something in excess of $900,000. So to get there, they have to have admissible evidence of the revenue side, which is what the whole sanctions business is partly about, because all of that relates only to revenues, not the costs. They have to prove what the revenues would have been, and they have to prove what the costs would have been.
Well, the issue is not whether they get to $900,000. The issue is whether they get before a jury.
Correct.
So why isn't there enough to get them before the jury?
Well, with respect to the costs, Your Honor, the only thing they presented to the trial judge was these two affidavits. And affidavits have to contain admissible evidence in order to consider them in opposition to summary judgment. Why weren't those affidavits, why didn't they have admissible evidence? Ms. Wood says, here's what the expenses would have been. She doesn't explain why. She has no documentary backup. She doesn't refer to any business plan or any business model. She's just basically saying it. Now, the question is that enough? And we submit it's not, and there's case law directly on that from Judge, now Justice Samuel Alito, in a case we cited, MBIA Insurance versus Royal Indemnity. Same situation. That one involved a dispute over the meaning of a contract, so the legal issue is slightly different. The defendant there, Royal, puts in an affidavit from one of its employees who says, when the contract was entered into 10 years ago, here was my intent, and that's it. Judge Alito says that Hibbard's subjective impression of what the parties meant, recollected years after the events in question, is at very best a scintilla of evidence in support of Royal's position, therefore not admissible for purposes of opposing summary judgment. That's just what we have here.
What does his view have to do with Delaware law?
Well, his view has to do with Delaware law because the summary judgment rule that he was construing under Federal Rule 56 also applies to our Rule 56. And the issue is the affidavit, does it contain admissible evidence to oppose summary judgment? So I think it's directly on point, Chief Justice. Now, here we have an affidavit from Gwen Wood, which is saying 10 years ago, so exactly the same point as Judge Alito, 10 years ago, the expenses would have been $200 a month. Just as with Mr. Hibbard in the Royal case, there's no explanation, there's no backup. And in our view, Judge Del Pesco correctly concluded that that was not admissible. And there's more, because we had asked in interrogatories right after your remand last time in the spring of 06, tell us all the facts and all the computations supporting your claim for lost profits. We never heard about this stuff that's in the Gwen Wood affidavit or the Joseph McCary affidavit. And
weren't these affidavits put in after the trial court said that their expert was going to be kept out?
No. They were put in on May 30th in opposition to our summary judgment motion before the ruling on Daubert was issued and before the hearing on Daubert had occurred. So it was slightly before.
But you had challenged the expert's opinion, correct?
When these affidavits were signed, we had, yes, our motion had been filed by that time, yes. So we were never given notice in interrogatory responses that they were going to rely on this information. And so it was too late for that reason as well. But the main point with these affidavits relative to cost is that they do not say enough to constitute admissible evidence, and for that reason, they are not sufficient to enable Empire to get to the jury.
Well, all right, let's assume that person testified on the witness stand to everything in the affidavit, and your objection would be under what rule?
Our objection would be under Rule 402, is it? It's not admissible because it's not relevant, and the reason it's because it doesn't say enough. You can't just say, here's my conclusion. That's not admissible. You can't just say, 10 years ago when I was working for the company, the costs were X. You need to have backup. You need to have an explanation. They have not a single document has ever been produced that supports this proposition. No business plan saying, gee, we were going to just go into the business of having one back office and simply collect on paying and legal accounts. There's nothing like that. It's simply an isolated statement that has no support.
But it's an isolated statement under oath.
Well, it is under oath, but it's also an opinion, which gets to my final point about it.
Well, wait a second. Why is it an opinion and not a statement of fact? This witness, as I understand it, worked in the business, and she's testifying that this is how much money it costs to collect on these accounts.
No, she's... Well, not exactly, and we can look closely. It's on pages A1987 and 1988. But that's the Gwen Wood affidavit. What she's saying is, basically, if we were just collecting on legal accounts, she only talks about the legal accounts, it would have cost this. I think it is an opinion in fairness, Justice Berger. And we had also asked in interrogatories, again back to the ground being shifted as the case goes forward, we asked in interrogatories, tell us all the opinions that will be expressed by lay opinion witnesses as well as by expert witnesses. Their responses with respect to lay opinion witnesses were, see expert testimony. In other words, they committed right after your remand not to use lay opinion testimony, and Gwen Wood's testimony is lay opinion testimony as well as being inadmissible because it's just a free-floating statement that has no support.
Well, the court can grant relief from that prior interrogatory answer.
The court can if asked. They never asked. We raised this in our papers. They never asked. But, yes, certainly a trial judge has the discretion to do that if the judge chooses to. My time is up. Thank you.
As far as Gwen Wood's or the interrogatory with regard to the testimony of lay witnesses, that interrogatory was objected. In addition to responding that expert testimony would be referred to, the interrogatory was objected to as being overly broad. They never followed up on it to determine whether or not to challenge that objection. As to the cost to collect these, the bank admits that the cost is less than 100%. According to their expert, they claim 88%. There's a positive figure based on whatever was collected. Even if you buy into their position that our expenses were 88% of revenues, there's still a positive figure which goes in front of a jury. As far as Mr. McCary's deposition is concerned, Mr. Grant did question him about the cost to collect the paying and legal accounts. He broke off the it's in the deposition, it's in the record. He broke off the discussion when Mr. McCary was testifying and said, when we could do this from home on a home computer, we'd have no office. He asked about overhead and such. She'd have no office expense. And he mentioned something about janitorial. He said Gwen would have to do her own janitorial work. He stopped asking questions about the expenses at that time.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.